Case number 08-7094, Robert L. Ord, Appellant versus District of Columbia. Mr. LaFan for Appellant, Mr. Kim for Appellee.
May it please the court, my name's Matthew LaFondi. I'm here on behalf of Appellant Robert Ord, a citizen of the Commonwealth of Virginia. The district court's August 29, 2008 dismissal of Robert Ord's complaint quickly pigeonholed his case as one of Navigar pre-enforcement. On page 4 of the opinion, the court was quick to say because Ord has not been arrested and prosecuted, Ord's case constitutes a pre-enforcement challenge. The appellant immediately takes exception to this conclusion in that the applying pre-enforcement doctrine to a case where an arrest warrant was actually issued and the defendant, District of Columbia's agents, actively attempted to execute this warrant, it takes Navigar to an extreme which is inappropriate. Indeed, the present facts prompted a rather diverse pair of amici to offer a brief on behalf of the appellant. The exaggeration of the act and attenuated application of Navigar.
Well, it sounds like you're making a different argument than the amicus. You're arguing that you have standing under Navigar. They're arguing that we should overrule.
Yes, very much so. That is correct. And
so you're not going as far as they did.
I am very happy for the court to adopt the amicus position on it. It reaches the same conclusion for my client. In that,
do you think we have to do that to rule for your client?
I think that the path of least resistance for this court is to distinguish Navigar. We certainly did not set out to overturn this court's precedent. We're simply trying to prosecute a civil claim which has remarkably different circumstances than those of Navigar, in that there has been this arrest warrant issued for this particular person, that there is a memorandum circulating within the Metropolitan Police Department specifically targeting a class of persons, which includes appellant, these Virginia law enforcement officers, and that under the facts alleged, there's a substantial controversy between the parties having adverse legal interests of sufficient immediacy and reality to warrant such relief.
Do you want to discuss the government's threshold argument about your Fourth Amendment claim is so insubstantial that the court lacks jurisdiction?
Right. Yeah. And I think the problem there is in the district court's application of the facts to the case, where that they say that the declaration of this null prosequi, the nolle, does not demonstrate that the district has any intention of further pursuing him for alleged violations of the disputed provisions. This is in pages 9 and 10 of the order at Joint Appendix 4243. And the court goes on to say, indeed, the affirmative step by the district to nullify the warrant is strong evidence that the district does not presently intend to prosecute Ord. The nullified warrant, therefore, does not demonstrate a threat of prosecution reaching the level.
You're still talking about standing. What about Judge Rogers' question?
In other words, the government, as I understand its argument, takes the position that there is absolutely no circumstance under which your client could demonstrate a Fourth Amendment violation.
And therefore, right, and that goes to the cases that were cited on the footnote of that same page, Joint Appendix 43. This is the Willis Bay Department of Corrections case, District Court case from 2007, quoting the 76 Supreme Court case Moody v. Daggett. In both of these cases, these involved detainers that were issued for parolees, persons who were released from the corrections at the sole discretion of the Department of Corrections, and then were later apprehended for violations. One of these persons had violated their probation on or parole on 6 different occasions. I hope that the court can see a very big distinction here in that where a person who the district never alleged to be in the District of Columbia is charged with a violation of District of Columbia firearm statutes, has a warrant issued for their arrest, and agents go into Virginia looking for this person for several days, and this person then foregoes a very lucrative security business in the District of Columbia worth some several hundred thousand dollars. We posit to the court that this is a Fourth Amendment deprivation of the manner that was described in Albright v. Oliver by Justice Ginsburg in her concurrence, the 1994 case 510 United States Reporter 2.
Well, you would agree, wouldn't you, that there was a prosecution pending.
And
her concurrence goes to that circumstance. So here the argument is there's no prosecution pending. The government has nollied.
And that brings up an interesting point about where along this continuum a plaintiff could ever find relief, where there's this Navigar pre-enforcement prior to the prosecution, there's Younger abstention in the midst of that prosecution, and then the government suddenly stops prosecuting when it's evident that their unconstitutional behavior is going to become scrutinized, and they simply discontinue the prosecution, and then this court, then the district court says that we're back to pre-enforcement. By that logic, there's never any time that this person can seek relief.
Your argument, though, was that your client meets the requirements of Navigar, all right? So there could be a case, even with Navigar in place, because of the Brito memo and the action that the government took, and they haven't stepped back from that memo, and they haven't said that they're not going to prosecute your client in the future. And indeed, they concede in their brief that second element of the test, and simply say you haven't alleged, or your client hasn't alleged, that he's going to come back into the district as the United Workers case. But I'm still back to this first question. You're saying that the nature of government action here is such that your client could demonstrate, or that the Fourth Amendment violation that your client alleges is not so insubstantial as to be mythical.
Very much so, in that the Fourth Amendment violation, and the text of the amendment could not be clearer, is that, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause. And that is the issue that we have here before the court, is that a warrant was issued for Robert Ord's arrest absent any probable cause, and this was immediately brought to the attention of the prosecutors. I was in that office the very next morning with ample and spoke to anybody who would listen to me to say, you have no probable cause to arrest this person. And yet the District of Columbia persisted for several days in attempting to execute this warrant, and to this day has never relented in its assertion that the conduct was lawful and proper. They went so far as to make misrepresentations to this council to assuage me in my concern, and to reasonably forego seeking a judge in chambers hearing to quash the warrant once they had told me that we have no intention of going forward with the warrant. It wasn't until much later in the day that, in fact, they made this affirmative statement that we have made a decision not to quash this warrant yet. And that persisted until 30 minutes before the judge in chambers hearing, where I would have had, for the first and apparently the only opportunity, to have any judicial review of the legality of the warrant. In the interim, the District of Columbia actively pursued the apprehension of this person, even though they were in a foreign jurisdiction, and that the agents of the Metropolitan Police Department were seen in the immediate vicinity of the appellant's workplace in Manassas.
I am still not sure that I've sorted out your arguments here. I mean, one argument is that even under Navigar, your client meets the standard because there's an imminent threat. of prosecution. But another argument would be that the issuance of the warrant itself was the constitutional violation, and that is something that had already occurred.
Those would be the two elements of my argument, and then there's a distinct argument to MedImmune with the amici.
So is your first argument that this is, in fact, not a pre-enforcement case at all?
Very much so, yes. That is our position. And we're having a hard time finding an analogous case on this. We talk a little bit about these Eighth Amendment issues of restriction of movement for pretrial once these persons have entered into this prosecution, and what Justice Ginsburg had to say about that. Judge Rogers properly points out that the prosecution had already been initiated, but I don't think it can be said that once a warrant has been signed and these folks are out looking for my client, that a prosecution had not also been initiated, and that this is very much an instance of where the appellant's freedom of movement has been hindered by government acts intentionally applied. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for Appellee.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Todd Kim for the District of Columbia. The District Court here was quite correct to dismiss this complaint for lack of jurisdiction. There are two independent reasons for so concluding. One is the standing issue, about which most of Appellant's presentation was directed, but the second is the insubstantiality of any federal claim. I'd like to start with that.
Which one? You're going to start with the insubstantial claim?
That's right, the insubstantiality of any federal claim.
Uh-huh.
We look at the Fourth Amendment cause of action that Appellant attempts to assert here, and we can divide it analytically into two portions. First is the backward-looking portion, and second is the forward-looking portion.
Why isn't this just an argument on the merits?
I'm sorry?
Why isn't this just an argument on the merits? It was dismissed under 12b-1, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, your brief reads like a merits argument. You may be right that the case, count one is without merit, but why is that issue before us now?
There is a category of causes of action that are so insubstantial, within the words of the Supreme Court, so attenuated as to be completely devoid of merit, that the federal courts lack jurisdiction to rule upon them. We believe this falls within that category. You compare this case, for instance, to the Decatur Liquors case, and I think that provides a good guidepost for determining how insubstantial a case needs to be in order not even to fall within the federal court's jurisdiction.
When we dismiss a case for lack on this grounds, I'm looking at Best versus Kelly, for example. I mean, the plaintiff here hasn't suggested any, quote, bizarre conspiracy or any, quote, fantastic manipulation of their will, no sort of supernatural claims. Those are the kinds of things, right? Oh, maybe you think he has, but I don't think so. And you don't say so in your brief.
No, I concede that there's no supernatural
allegation. Why isn't this just a merits argument? Why don't we just let the district court deal with this? This isn't jurisdictional.
I respectfully disagree. I think this court and the Supreme Court both recognize there are certain types of non-supernatural theories that are nonetheless so attenuated that they don't fall within the federal court's jurisdiction. I recognize that it can be a hard line to draw.
Sure is.
Yeah. But I think, again, you can compare this case to the Decatur Liquors case. Particular theories that appellant pursues here, we think, are insubstantial. But if this court disagrees, and I recognize that it may because it is a difficult line to draw, again, I refer the court to the Decatur Liquors case, this court has the authority, after determining that it has jurisdiction, to, even though the district court dismissed for lack of jurisdiction, rule that the complaint failed to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. It's discretionary, I recognize that. This court need not do that.
Can we focus on this, on your first argument, your standing?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely.
This focuses on their what you call their pre-enforcement challenge, count four, right? So, in the district court, as I understood the district's argument, it was that there was no plausible risk of prosecution because a warrant had been dropped, right?
That was not the entirety of it, Your Honor.
It wasn't?
No, it was not. If you look at page 8 of our motion to dismiss, we clearly state that one of the independent reasons why the complaint could not proceed was because plaintiff had not alleged an intention even to bring any concealed weapons into the district.
Okay. Well, let me get to that in a minute.
Okay. Okay.
But at page 24 of your brief?
Of our appellate brief?
Yeah, of the brief here. You say that the district now agrees that Ord's allegation that the district applied for an arrest warrant were sufficient to show such a special priority. So you now concede, right, that the only issue now is whether he's shown, alleged any intention to return to the district.
Right, sufficiently.
Correct? You agree with that?
Yes, that's where we are. I agree with that.
Okay. So you agree, we interpret the complaint. This is 12B1, right? We give the plaintiff the benefit of all inferences, correct? And we assume the facts in the complaint are true.
Yes, Your Honor, I'm afraid I have to have a yes but there.
Pardon me?
Yes, certainly, for purposes of 12B6.
Yeah, I know you have a but. Yeah, right.
Well,
I got your butt.
Summary judgment standards should apply here, not only motion dismissed.
Wasn't this dismissed under 12B1?
Absolutely, but if you look at this court's decision in Termo-Rio, I think the circumstances here are quite similar to those there.
I thought we could only move from at 12B6 converted to summary judgment, no? Isn't that right?
I think the conversion rule
only works for 12B6, not 12B1.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not familiar with that limitation. I'll take your word for the purpose of this argument.
Okay, but what I want to ask you about is, why would he be filing? I guess I have two questions. Number one, why would he be filing this complaint if he didn't intend to return to the district armed? And isn't that pretty clear from his affidavit? He says that he has a license in the district, right? His company does.
His company does.
His company has a license, okay.
He also does say that he abandoned all his existing business contracts in the district.
Yeah, but he does say that. But the other affidavit says, it's true he's abandoned it, but that's because he can't come into the district now. And the other affidavit explains, he says, while I was once able, I'm reading one of his affidavits, while I was once able to enter the District of Columbia with my firearm as a police officer, I can no longer do so. He says, quote, it's impossible for me to go to one location or another. I have no place to put my gun. I mean, this whole case is someone who is telling us that but for this threat of prosecution, he would be returning to the district carrying his weapon. What more does he need to say?
I have a couple of responses, Your Honor.
Sure.
First, we think that United Farm Workers and Seegers, on their terms, aside from general principles of 12B analysis, require an allegation that he simply did not make.
Which is what?
An allegation of an intention to engage in a course of conduct infected with a constitutional interest, but arguably prescribed. He never squarely makes that allegation.
Why I asked you about our obligation to interpret the complaint liberally and give him all inferences. I mean, I don't know how you can read this complaint and these affidavits without acknowledging that his basic claim in here is that he wants to return to the district armed. Now, true, he doesn't say that in so many words, but I think our obligation is to read it that way. Otherwise, why would he be here?
I think, again, my first response to that is, aside from normal principles of analysis under Rule 12B, the Supreme Court has told us that there has to be a square allegation on that regard. And perhaps that's because these pre-enforcement challenges are an odd creature in normal federal court jurisdiction.
Well, except that this one's a little different because you've already acknowledged that the existence of the previous warrant creates the reasonable risk of prosecution. So you were over that.
Agreed.
Because of your concession.
I don't think that takes us out of the category of pre-enforcement review, though.
No, but now the only question factually is whether or not there's enough of an allegation to keep him that he intends to return to the district.
No, I think the question on United Farm Workers and Seegers is whether he has made the square allegation that the precedent requires. And aside from that, again, we do think summary judgment standards should apply. But you understand my argument on that. So I'd like to actually turn to an analysis of the merits of both sides of the Fourth Amendment claim, both because we think that it shows the insubstantiality of those claims in a jurisdictional sense, but also because, again, this court has full authority to say, okay, we accept that the district court should have had jurisdiction or should have recognized as such. But on this complaint, we see no reason not to say that the judgment should be entered for the district based upon a failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. So we can get past the jurisdictional threshold but still have a judgment for the district. And let's analyze the two parts.
But that's only for count, you're talking about count one, right?
That's right. Only
count one.
Only count. The counts two and three are to local law claims, which even assuming the court affirms here, you can pursue.
Count four, which is which? Is count four is pre-enforced? What do you call is pre-enforced?
Count, yeah. He didn't separate them clearly in the district court. That's part of the confusion.
Your argument about the merits relates to count one.
That's right, Your Honor.
Count four, the only question there is standing, right?
I don't believe there is a count four in the complaint, not as far as I remember. Count one was entitled Deprivation of Liberty Interest, and I think it encompasses both sides of the Fourth Amendment claim I'm talking about, the forward-looking and the past-looking. Counts two and three were local law claims. There is no count four in the complaint. So count one encompasses
about his request for declaratory judgment.
Oh, I don't think he labeled that a separate count.
No, okay, you're right. And injunctive relief.
Right, right. Right. That's his prayer for relief. That's right.
You're actually right. But that's not what you're talking about now.
No, it is not. I'm talking currently about the merits of it, not about its particular request for relief.
Go ahead.
On count one, which is his Fourth Amendment claim, he makes clear it is a Fourth Amendment claim. He has two parts, and that only became analytically clear later, but let's go along with this analysis. There is the backward-looking part of it, and there is the forward-looking part of it. The backward-looking part of it is that their Fourth Amendment was violated, he says, when there was an arrest warrant executed without probable cause, again, he says, but the arrest warrant, it's undisputed, was never executed. Now, we made quite clear in our brief that we don't think there's a Fourth Amendment claim absent a search or a seizure. He has had full opportunity to come up with any case, and we have found none, finding a Fourth Amendment claim in the absence of a search or seizure. To the contrary, we have
What do you do with the Fourth Amendment, which says no warrant shall issue without probable cause?
Absolutely, and we read it in context. The sentence in the whole says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, homes, etc., shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause, blah, blah, blah. Sorry, I shouldn't blah, blah, blah the Constitution, but dot, 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 particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. So we think in context, that particular clause is meant to show what the standard is for determining when a warrant can issue to justify a search or a seizure. And if we look at the precedent, I think it's clear that you can't have a Fourth Amendment claim without a search or a seizure. The County of Sacramento explicitly says that. He rightly notes there are different factual circumstances there. But let's look at some of the other cases. Graham v. Connor in note 10 notes that the Fourth Amendment analysis starts at the time of the seizure. We have this court's decision in Pitt, which explicitly says malicious prosecution is actionable under 42 U.S.C. 1983 to the extent that the defendant's actions cause the plaintiff to be unreasonably seized without probable cause in violation of the Fourth Amendment. Yes, he does. But as we've all agreed, you look at pages 277 to 78 of the U.S. reports, and Justice Ginsburg makes clear her analysis is dependent upon the fact that there had been an arrest.
No, right. And I guess you're saying that no court consistent with the plain terms of the Fourth Amendment could find a Fourth Amendment violation.
I think there is no Fourth Amendment violation here, and there could not be, and it's plain, and he cites no case demonstrating it. To the contrary, he doesn't even respond to our cases showing that there is no Fourth Amendment cause of action here. Not only that, all the cases he cites in his reply brief, especially cases from the 2nd, 4th, 5th, and 11th circuits, all involve circumstances where there had been a seizure, every single one. We're aware of no case that supports his claim to a Fourth Amendment relief here. He may well have a cause of action under local law. The district court's judgment is no way consistent with his ability to pursue relief in the superior court. He asserted two causes of action under local law, malicious prosecution and intentional infliction of emotional distress. He may well have a cause of action there. He can pursue it. He has no federal cause of action justifying his presence in the district court and in this court. That's the past-looking analysis. If we look forward as well, his Fourth Amendment claim is equally invalid. As we discuss in our brief, and there is no meaningful response to it, the Supreme Court's decision in DeFilippo and this Court's decisions in Barwood and Doe, as well as just standard probable cause analysis, indicate that his theory that an arrest would be legally invalid can justify his proceeding on a prospective Fourth Amendment cause of action only if his legal theory is so obviously correct that no police officer, acting as he must, as a prudent, reasonable police officer based upon all the circumstances before him or her, would lack probable cause to arrest based upon his asserted status as a special conservator of the peace under Virginia law. It's simply not clear. We think it's clear that he would have no entitlement to the district's exemptions.
He would have no what?
We think it's clear that the district's exemptions would not apply to him, but this court need not go that far. In order to validate his Fourth Amendment cause of action here, that no officer could have probable cause, he'd have to show that his legal entitlement to those exemptions was bulletproof. We don't think he even approaches that showing for all the reasons in our brief. Separately, there's also a problem with his probable cause analysis under the Supreme Court's decision in Baker v. McCollin and various assorted following decisions. Baker made clear that in order to have a probable cause, an officer need not, quote, investigate independently every claim of innocence, whether the claim is based on mistaken identity or defense such as lack of requisite intent. So, at least conceivably, an officer in the future would not be in a circumstance where he or she could confirm Mr. Ord's status as a special conservator of the peace. If that is so, Mr. Ord's claim that a future police officer would necessarily lack probable cause fails. So for all these reasons, I see my time is pretty much up. Unless the court has further questions, I would ask the court to affirm the judgment for lack of jurisdiction for the reasons we discussed. But in any event, if it asserts jurisdiction, to recognize that this complaint has no reason to go forward and affirm based on failure to state a claim. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant.
Appreciate the court's recognition of the absence of bizarre conspiracy and suit the supernatural in the present proceedings.
I think the district agrees with that, too.
Thank you. I'd like just a moment to just...
But what do you do about Decatur? You don't even respond to that case in your brief.
Please.
That's a case they rely on in their argument that your claim is too insubstantial to go forward.
Yeah, and I have a very, very difficult time with this in that, first of all,
with
their application of this characterization of how insubstantial this may be, in that there is an enormous amount of money at stake here. There has been, we very easily put this in the context of a seizure, however constructive, that the District of Columbia has usurped this person's lawful right to do business in the district, that the District of Columbia has made this unlawful limitation on Ord's inherent right of travel, that the court is quite correct to read his affidavit in a hastily composed application for emergency relief, to read that he intended to come into the District of Columbia. There is, however, there's this issue of whether, unlike Parker and Seegers, this question of, well, we intend to come into the District of Columbia and possess firearms, but we know that it's illegal for us as a class of persons today. First of all, there was never any allegation that Ord had been in the District of Columbia in the first place. He was charged with a crime that never alleged he was here. And further, he also distinguishes these cases in that he, as a class of persons, quite explicitly stated by the circuit court in Virginia, exempt from federal and District of Columbia firearms laws. And while the district makes this very strange point that he might be revoked at some point in the future, they have all sorts of mechanisms in place before they arrest someone to verify that this person has a driver's license, that this person is not in has not had their parole revoked, that this person is a police officer. And that's the reason that the Virginia Circuit Courts order the Virginia State Police to enter this person's details and the order of their appointment into VSIN, which is the equivalent of Wales here in the District of Columbia. So I'm having a hard time understanding where they're getting this insubstantiality of claims. Ord has a right to travel into the District of Columbia. There was a clearly unconstitutional issuance of this warrant. However, the attenuated the district would like to now parse the Fourth Amendment in the manner that it once parsed the Second Amendment, and that he's lost a lot of money directly as a cause of the District of Columbia's unlawful acts. Speaking briefly to the summary judgment issue, I am unfamiliar with any instance where at 12B6, or certainly not a 12B1 motion, can be converted to summary judgment on appeal. It's my understanding that had the district court chosen to treat the District of Columbia's motion as a motion for summary judgment, the court would have had to give notice to the parties and provided an opportunity to provide all pertinent material. And I've got five district court cases from various circuits here that speak exactly to that. But that means that once it gets transferred from Rule 12 to Rule 56, the notice is given and the parties are given the opportunity to convert to provide additional materials, because the court says we're going to decide this on the sufficiency of the evidence that these folks are providing. And that certainly has not happened here. Up to the point of the court's characterization of the null prosy, the district court was actually rather deferential to Ord's allegations, as it should have been under Rule 12. It was only once the court considered in the footnote, on page 10 of the order, the affirmative step by the district to nullify the warrant is strong evidence that the district does not presently intend to prosecute Ord, was really the first time that the district court sort of overstepped Rule 12. I think that they were well within the confines of Rule 12 and being deferential to the allegations of the plaintiff right up to that point. So I don't see where we get how the court, the District of Columbia can somehow now speak to this being somehow a summary judgment motion. I'd like just a moment to just talk about Pearson v. Callahan, since that seems to be on the tip of everyone's tongue at the moment, in that when we're looking at this Fourth Amendment violation that is not necessarily a search or a seizure, but instead the issuance of this warrant absent probable cause and an allegation that even absent the arrest, serious injuries did occur. And the question, I would just simply put this through the lens of Pearson v. Callahan, and that Ord's rights were clearly defined, and that a person has a right to not have a warrant issued for their arrest for absent probable cause, and that the government's actions in that regard were unreasonable. If the court were to adopt the District of Columbia's position, it would give them free rein to issue warrants absent probable cause no matter what the circumstances were. And I think that is not a position that this court wishes to further. And for these reasons, that we ask that this matter be remanded back to the district court for trial, finding standing for the appellant.
Thank you, counsel. We will take the case under advisement.